Hello and welcome to the Health and Happiness Show on Untangled FM. I'm Edwina Griffin. I hope you all had a stress-free week after chatting with Lauren Miller last week. Now, we often think of our day-to-day stresses, but do you ever wonder what the future will hold for us on this planet Earth? As the world's population grows into our future, how is it we're going to be able to continue to live these healthy, happy lives in ways that are environmentally and economically sustainable? Today, I'm excited to have on the show Executive Director of Starfish Enterprises, a growing network of community entrepreneurs collaborating to contribute to the global transition for sustainability. He's the chair of the Minerals Policy Institute, Sydney Leadership Alumnus, and member of the Great Transition Initiative. He has qualifications in commerce and taxation law and blends a strong business and organisation acumen with expertise in working with complexity, multi-stakeholder and multi-culture processes, learning and leadership facilitation, strategic planning, human consciousness and well-being. He has a diverse career spanning environmental, social, corporate and government sectors. His work focuses on improving the well-being of communities in ways that are environmentally and economically sustainable. I'd like to welcome my friend and social change strategist, Adam Blakester. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks very much, Edwina.
Thanks for joining us. Now, I read on your Starfish site that you believe humanity has entered a paradigm storm. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Often we hear that term perfect storm after the book and movie of the same name, and I really liked that concept, but I didn't like the negativity of it. And we hear that often in pop culture these days of, you know, we've got a perfect storm and it's applied to crime or health issues or our economic malaise or whatever. And I thought, well, part of this change that's going on at the moment in terms of how much more aware, how much more conscious and how much more capable we are, and anyone who's studied history, even going back a couple of hundred years, let alone going back 20 or 40,000 years, couldn't help but concur that we are profoundly more capable in all of those realms. Then this idea of a paradigm storm, a paradigm is simply a change of a large scale, like a change of worldview, a change on a system-wide scale or even on a global scale. And there are so many changes going on. And broadly, I think those changes fall into one of two buckets. There are a whole lot of changes that are happening because we're creating them. Technology is one of the easy examples to look at, where we can look at just how profoundly the range and usefulness of technology we've got available to us today that even 30 years ago was scarcely imaginable. And that's technology in health, technology in communication, technology in transportation, and so on. The other bucket of big changes are ones that are happening because they're absolute necessities. If we look at what's going on economically in Western Europe, particularly at the moment, and to a degree in North America as well, if we look at issues around food scarcity in some developing countries, so these are changes where we're realising that it's sheer necessity. We need to do things profoundly differently. And the number of places where I sit in rooms these days where there's a mixture of government, business, community organisations, just, you know, average individuals who are trying to grapple with deeper, more profound change because they realise that that's what's needed. It's not to say that the system is broke, though in certain places that might be fair to say. It is to say, though, that what we need to be looking at and what we need to be doing and how we need to be working is so significantly different to how it is now that it's a paradigm change. And so whether we look across health, we look across energy systems, transportation, the booming of global population, the booming of not only have we got a growing population, but a growing quality of life and standard of living. Like all of these things, layer upon layer, for me, are a paradigm storm. But humanity has never been through anything like this before in all of history.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, great explanation. I understand what you're talking about. So when you're talking about this paradigm storm, I guess we then shift into sustainability and what is sustainability? You know, how do you define sustainability?
Yeah, look, sustainability, in simple terms, it's the ability to continue something in perpetuity, infinitely into the future. So if we were to look at our, you know, standard of health and well-being today, for instance, the question of whether it was or wasn't sustainable would challenge us to look at what are all of the ingredients, all of the requirements for us to have this standard of health and well-being, and can we sustain all of those ingredients, all of those requirements indefinitely into the future. If, for example, our health and well-being was highly dependent on scarce non-renewable resources, and I would argue that it is, for instance, the incredible dependency of our health system for high levels of energy and materials that are currently mostly sourced non-renewable, from non-renewable sources, so let's say fossil fuels and building materials, then there's a need to make changes in order to be sustainable. So that's what sustainability is in the simplest sense. There's a lot of other similar terms that are used. I think the wellness movement, you could almost just replace the word sustainability with wellness. By the time you dive into wellness and a more holistic concept of health and well-being, then all of the issues we're talking about in natural environment, economic, livelihoods, work environments and so on come into play, as we know they do, because they affect positively through to negatively on our wellness. The social responsibility movements, ethical in investment terms and more widely movements, fair trade, there's quite a number of large movements that I think it's fair to say all mean pretty similar things to what sustainability means. I think all of them have got a time and a place. I don't get too hung up about which one is right or best. I think what's more at stake is what they mean and how useful they are and how do we go about achieving them.
And how did you get involved in this area of sustainability? You know, what's brought you to this place of, I mean, you've established Starfish Enterprises and brought the community of entrepreneurs together, and how did this evolve?
Yeah, well, Starfish is about 4 years old now, so it's really the most recent foray into this space. What I realised about probably 5 or 6 years ago was when I looked back on my career and all the different things that I'd been involved in personally and professionally, as you've been saying in the introduction, I'd worked across and started in the finance, accounting and law sector, and did a lot of work with business and taxation and so on, and then moved into the environmental movement. I worked with Greenpeace for nearly 12 years, and as an accountant moving into Greenpeace, and initially my role was in that financial area, but I took with a fervour studying and learning and getting to understand all of the natural environment issues and that Greenpeace worked on. And then following on from that, I worked in the children's sector, and again, moving into a new sector, took it upon myself to learn as much as I humanly could about children's well-being, which invariably linked into family and community well-being and functioning as well. And so I sat back and went, well, that's normally what we're trying to juggle in sustainability. If we picture a simple stool, a breakfast stool at the kitchen table that's got three legs, one of the legs is financial, one of them is environmental, and one of them is social. And if those three legs are balanced and strong, then the stool, we can sit on it, we're sustainable, so to speak. And so I reflected on that and thought, well, this is what we're trying to do now, is to juggle these things. I mean, the example I think that we're most familiar with, particularly in the developed world, is that the economic leg of that stool trumps the social and trumps particularly the environmental. So, you know, a throwaway remark along the lines of, well, we need to do these things to the environment because we need economic activity, we need homes, we need cars, we need transport, we need health systems. Yet, if that economic leg dominates so greatly that all of a sudden the natural systems become so frail and so degraded, then our very life is threatened by that, and it becomes counterproductive and very paradoxical. So that's where we are now as an organisation, and where I am in my life's work, is saying, how do we find these sweet spots where they're environmentally, economically and socially good for us, where we're not compromising one or the other, because that's only a short-term possibility. You can't get away with that long-term. And again, coming back to my opening remarks, with 7 billion people and 80% of the world at the moment live on about 20% of the resources, and that's changing. That's changing very rapidly. We've got more and more people in less developed countries getting cars, houses, technology, you know, wanting transport access to aeroplanes and so on. So we've got this exponential increase going on in our environmental footprint, our resource footprint, our economic requirements. So the kind of solutions we're looking for now need to be totally different. They need to be the next level of evolution from what we've had before, whether we're talking energy, whether we're talking the kind of work we do, whether we're talking the lifestyles and culture we have, whichever way we look at it. And it's, you know, it'd be wonderful to say we've got the answers to that, but I think it's truer to say that's the journey before us now. We need to revel in the uncertainty of that journey. There's a beautiful quote about not being able to find distant lands. If you're, you know, going back a couple of hundred years and sailing in a ship across the horizon in the sea, you can't find distant lands unless you lose sight of your own shore for a very long time. And that's, I feel, where we are now as a global village on this planet, is at the beginning of losing sight of our own shore, letting go of what's familiar, because we know we need to, and we've got a sense of where we're going to get to. We've got a deep inner knowing that that's the way we've got to go, but boy, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of, you know, a lot of fear that will come up for most people.
Now, and you've moved out of Sydney now into a regional area, New England. What are the trends with people living in regional and urban areas in Australia and around the world? Is there a shift in that way of living and the way, you know, living in community versus city existence and the way of thinking of communities working together? It seems you've created a very successful sort of community cooperative environment in the New England area. I just wondered, is that the model that you see for the future, or how do you see that in terms of patterns worldwide? Mm.
One of the biggest patterns worldwide is the fact that as of about a year ago, more people on Earth lived in cities than otherwise. So more people lived in cities than rural and regional areas for the first time in human history. In Australia, we hold the title of being the most urbanised of any of the economic developed countries on Earth. And it's somewhere in the vicinity of 90-odd percent of Australians live in urban areas, and many of those what I would call uber urban areas, the big metropolises where you're talking, you know, multiple millions of people living together. So that's one of the big changes. I think one of the other changes, and this is observable not only in Australia but also in the United States. I've not studied it further afield, but my guess would be that it's a similar pattern, is that there's been a decline in the perceived quality of life that's available in living in a rural or regional area, that they're a bit of a backwater. You know, the most common story that people have in their mind about farming, for instance, is just how incredibly unpredictable, volatile and heartbreaking it can be. You know, your vulnerability to weather and weather changes, make or break, you know, rain, flood, extreme winds and so on. So there's some of the bigger changes going on. Underneath the surface, though, what's interesting is in rural and regional areas, there's a world of difference. There's such a variety of places, and certainly New England, my family and I, we spent 5 years researching and studying where we would move to live. And a lot of people thought we were moving to get away from things, you know, moving out of Sydney, moving to the country. It sounded like a relaxed kind of shift in life. And there's certainly lots of aspects to it that are much more relaxed as I sit here in my office looking out at the bush and, you know, can hear the birds waking up and all of those things is just magnificent. But really, we wanted to move into the thicker things. We wanted to move into the heart of this great transition to sustainability. And the New England is a standout for its qualities in that regard. It's got some of the world's most advanced agricultural practice. It is a university town and a university that has a very high international student population, so its cultural diversity is quite extraordinary for a regional centre. The presence of the university and a whole lot of other education facilities means it's got a very large professional class as well, accounting, law, researchers, IT and so on, that again are not so typically found in rural or regional areas, and the list goes on. And there's increasing numbers of rural and regional areas that have people moving to them because they find that there's the space to be more creative, whether they're moving into niche markets in agriculture or whether they're, you know, what are called nomads, it's a nice term. So knowledge-based workers who with technology can be located largely anywhere, so long as they've got access to transport. I think they need from time to time to do face-to-face engagement. So these are some of the changes going on in the rural and regional area, which absolutely fascinate me, and that's where Starfish squarely focuses on rural and regional sustainability. By contrast, there's a growing body of research in terms of the more centralised things become, and cities are very, very centralised when you just think about the sheer number of people all living on top of each other, the businesses located there. There are economies of scale that come with that, undeniably. I mean, New York is often touted as one of the most sustainable places to live because within 300 or 400 metres of your front door, you've got absolutely everything you could ever need. And you can't match that in a large rural and regional area. But at some points, it becomes harder and harder to service something that's really centralized. The energy needs to come in from further afield. The food needs to come in from further afield. The congestion and the noise become factors in play. And so I think one of the challenges we've got is there's almost an unquestioned view at the moment on Earth, which is cities are the place to be, and that this swell of population moving into them, which is unbelievably large. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of people moving into cities, and, you know, more than 3.5 billion now living in them in total. But this is the way to go. And I think we just need to be really careful with that, because pretty much every civilization that's ever collapsed has collapsed because of over-specialization and over-centralization. And so it's not, I don't want to put the mocker on cities. I don't want this to be about which one's right or wrong. But I think we need to leave no stone unturned. And by contrast, I think it's fair to say that mostly rural and regional areas are not widely considered as being that relevant in a global setting. Yet they're incredibly relevant for energy generation, food and fibre production, and as a valuable place to be in their own right. And increasingly with technology and the movement of people, they can be as contemporary and you know, relevant places and far from the kind of redneck backwater that they're often dismissed as being.
You know, what projects are you involved in, speaking of the fact that regional areas are important and the role that they play in energy and providing food and things? What are some of the projects that Starfish is involved in at the moment in the New England area?
We're working on a community-owned wind farm. That's one of the more complex and ambitious projects. So it's obviously renewable energy in terms of wind power, but the bundling that with community ownership means it's got some really interesting economic aspects to it as well, because the local people and local businesses are the majority shareholders. That's the model we're working for. We're working on a educational facility in a rather remarkable community and town called Bingara. They're setting up what they call the Living Classroom, which is converting about 150 acres of their town commons, converting that into a living, working model of regenerative or sustainable agriculture. So that's a fascinating project. We're also working on one that's quite cultural in its take and has got a lot of relevance in terms of social health and emotional health, which is the Mile Creek Massacre Memorial. And so that is one of the many hundreds of sites that were a massacre of Aboriginal people by the colonial Europeans when they were moving across the landscape and taking control of land for agriculture. The remarkable thing about Mile Creek is that it's the only case in Australian history where the perpetrators of the massacre were found guilty at law, and for that significance, it's played a really amazing role in terms of Australian legislation. And coming forward to today, there's an annual memorial where the descendants of the perpetrators of the massacre and the descendants of the victims of the massacre come together in an act of healing and reconciliation. And it's quite profound in how it's affecting people and how it is a symbol for, I think, one of the many great challenges we have, not only in Australia but globally, is how do we become a global village of many cultures? How do we move beyond historic patterns of one culture dominating another culture? And that unequivocally has been the pattern up to now. So, they're three of the projects, and they nicely span the more environmentally oriented ones, like the agricultural facility. Even though the wind farm is certainly environmental, and the renewable energy aspect of it has got profound environment, it's probably fair to say it's more about the economics of communities coming together to pool their financial resources and start creating their own infrastructure in a way that they want it to be, and owning it. I mean, that turns on its head the economic paradigm that dominates us at the moment of global and multinational corporates and decision-making made by stock exchanges anywhere in the world. I mean, this is a very powerful paradigm. And then the Mile Creek, which is, of course, very firmly in the social and cultural. So, and all are profoundly challenging, to be frank. Like, any one of them could consume your life, really.
Absolutely. Now, the wind farms do interest me, because I've heard a lot about wind farming and seen them popping up everywhere around New South Wales. But, I'd love a few questions on that, because I have had discussions with people about it, and I don't really know enough. I find a lot of people don't know enough about wind farming and in terms of, the potential noise and health hazards of having them, and how much power do they generate and how many do you need. And, could you give us sort of a bit of a background on things like that? Because I know that's the objections that have come up sort of in my head and in friends' heads on whether or not, we've got a place in the country. Do we want wind farms on there? And how much power is it actually going to give us? And in terms of that sustainability in the future, how does it work?
Yep. Okay. Well, let's start with noise. I think noise has become a very controversial but very much a red herring. If we think of the density of wind farm development in Europe, which is quite extraordinary, and in Europe we have wind farms that are situated often even in the village, in the centre of villages they might have a turbine. Interestingly, in Europe, the most common model of wind farm development is local farmers and local community members pooling their money. So it's more of a community model than the kind of model that we're seeing in Australia, where it's a large corporation putting in hundreds of turbines along ridgelines. So that creates a different dynamic in the community. It's very different if you have a couple of hundred turbines coming and one or two property owners are going to be earning, anywhere between $5,000 and $15,000 per turbine per annum rent, but the next neighbour down the valley or further up the ridgeline looks at it all day but isn't earning a penny. That this is some of the differences in Europe where people have come together and done it together. And you can imagine that if there were genuine health effects, so whether we're talking infrasound, which is one of the bits of jargon that's been created around this red herring, or just straight out noise, then we'd have people dropping left, right and centre in Europe and North America for that matter. And the reality is we don't. The noise qualities of wind farms are, they do make noise, and there are lots of things in our environment that make noise that doesn't affect us, at a fundamental health level. So from a point of view of science and research, there is no peer-reviewed evidence whatsoever that wind farms cause ill health due to noise, whether that's noise we can hear or noise that we can't hear because it's, you know, below our hearing level. So that's one thing. And what's interesting is when you trace back the individuals who are promoting these noise and other issues, there's a term that's been coined now, renewable energy denialist, which is a little bit like a climate change skeptic or denialist. And there's plenty of research going on now into who are the people and the people behind those people who are putting these messages and putting this information into the public domain, into our communities about, for instance, the noise health issues. And invariably, they have very strong links back to fossil fuel industries. And so we can't underestimate the level of vested interest there is in the current system of energy, with coal, gas, oil particularly. South Australia in Australia has got the most significant deployment of wind farms. In fact, last year, South Australia generated 26% of their electricity from wind. So in terms of your question about, you know, how much power can these things produce, they're by far and away the most capable of the renewable energy technologies compared to solar or compared to tidal or wave or wind turbines are the most advanced and the most capable of all of those technologies. So in South Australia, not only was 26% of their electricity last year created by wind, but the amount of electricity that they sourced from gas and from coal reduced by a similar amount. So that's one of the other concerns that people often have, is because they're trying to get their head around the fact that the wind doesn't blow all the time, and of course it doesn't. A commercially viable wind farm site, the wind will blow give or take one third of the time to a level that the wind farm is producing a sufficient capacity of wind. But that's what the electricity grid does. If you were to come to a home and say, oh, look, I want to just have wind power for my home, then you would need a very large storage system, whether that was batteries or whether that was using water as a battery system and pushing water up a hill and then running it back through a small turbine and using water as a battery. But either way, you would need a system to store energy for the two-thirds of the time the wind isn't blowing. But we're not plugging wind turbines just into one house with no connection to other power sources. We're actually connecting them into the electricity grid, and so connecting them to a whole lot of other power sources. And this is where the grid works essentially like a battery and a switching system, in that it's able to constantly adjust, and it does adjust on a very small time scale. It's constantly adjusting the amount of power that's being generated and pushed into the grid with the amount of power that's being taken out of the grid. So wind certainly works and certainly reduces our use of coal and gas and other fossil fuels. So those are big ticks. And in terms of health issues, you know, even things like birds come up in that regard. A lot of these things, I think, actually come back to good planning, and it's why I mentioned the European example. If you have a wind farm built on your property boundary and the whole time you've lived there, you used to have this beautiful vista, this amazing scenery, and all of a sudden you've got a wind farm being built there. A coal mine would be no different. And you've had very little or no say in the fact that that's happened. You might have been invited to meetings, you were invited to find out about it, but you couldn't actually change that decision. When we don't have control over our own life, that really knocks around our health and well-being. It creates stress, it creates anxiety, and that can create a whole lot of other problems. And my sense is from reading all the literature in this area that the main problem we have with wind farms, and it's not different to other kinds of development, is that the people who are affected by that development aren't involved in the decision making. And that creates problems and even false problems, like I'm getting sick from the noise, when I think it's probably more likely that I'm sick of that bloody wind farm and I can hear it constantly, you know, because it just is constantly on my mind that I don't want it there, it shouldn't have been there, I couldn't control it, what do I do now? I think those are more accurately the realities that we're dealing with.
So what success are you having with the wind farming that you're doing in the New England? Like, have you been able to overcome those problems, or how do you see that obstacle being overcome in the future?
Yeah, the way we've gone about developing the community wind farm, in my knowledge, is probably one of the most unique development processes anywhere in the world. Some of the differences that I'm referring to are particularly in terms of how we have been planning it. We started about 2 years ago now with a series of public forums and planning meetings, surveys, one-on-one meetings and so on, working across the New England Tablelands, which is a large geographical area. The population here is about 45,000 people, and about 1,600 people were directly involved in these planning forums. And initially our focus was, do we want a community wind farm? If the answer is yes, how would we want that to work? What would be the rules of the game, so to speak? And so things that came out of that, overwhelmingly the answer was yes, we want one. There were some forums where there were individuals who were very strongly opposed to a wind farm. Their reasons were many, and many of them were similar to ones that you just mentioned. But what we then did was said, well, look, the only reason we're talking about a community wind farm is because we use electricity, and we would like to create the kind of electricity system that we're comfortable with, as opposed to using one that we're not comfortable with. And our near neighbours here is an area of Australia called the Liverpool Plain, which is arguably the most agriculturally productive area in Australia, and one of the most agriculturally productive areas in the world. Many of the farm operators there have never known a crop to fail, going back three and four generations. And that area of Liverpool Plain right now is under threat from coal mining of a magnitude that is almost unimaginable, the size and tonnage of coal that's looking at being extracted out of that area, and more recently, coal seam gas. So for us, a community wind farm is a choice about how do we want our electricity to be made. Nearly 94% of electricity in New South Wales is being made with coal at the moment, and the state government are prioritising coal seam gas as the way of the future. And overwhelmingly, like more than 95% of our community said, we do not want coal and we do not want coal seam gas. We don't want nuclear either, by the way, in case you want to know. What we want is solar, wind. We want clean energy. So that was how we began. And then the other aspect of this was, instead of, as happens with commercial wind farms, They most often study the maps of where the wind is and where the electricity, to a lesser degree, where the electricity grid is. They find locations where the wind is located, and prospecting is what it's called, a bit like in mining. And they will then go and start knocking on doors of landholders saying, look, we've found that there's really good wind here on your property and would like to speak with you about your interest in a wind farm. That can set up the kind of tensions and conflict in the community, as we were talking about before, where neighbours don't find out about it till much later when deals have already been done and so on. So what we did was instead invite landowners from right across the New England to volunteer their property to potentially be the location for the wind farm. So what we've now been able to do is map willing landowners with the wind maps of where there's wind and the electricity grid. And what we've been looking for in simple terms is where is it that we have not only a willing landowner but neighbours and wind and access to the electricity grid. And just a couple of days ago we had what we called a neighbourhood forum where we invited, there was about 40 near neighbours who attended that forum to the particular site that we are working on now. We've worked through 120 different properties that were voluntarily offered, and we've now whittled that down to the one that we think is the best of all of them. And 9 out of 10 people who were there raised their hand at the end of that meeting saying that they were happy and supportive for us to proceed. So there's still a lot more work we need to do. We're right at the very beginning of what will take 4 to 6 years to develop the wind farm, and we've got a lot of work, and a lot of challenges that we need to work through to be able to successfully do this. But at every step of the way, we're endeavouring to be more transparent, more inclusive, and in fact, what we're trying to do is have a community decision-making process where literally hundreds and potentially thousands of people are collectively agreeing to do this, as opposed to the current way that development occurs, which is where businesses work out where they can make money, government works out if it fits the rules, and community have some say in it, but not much.
A new way of decision making on all levels, really. It sounds like and is this a model created by New England area? Has it happened this way anywhere else in the world, or is this a new way of sort of collaborating and decision making towards the future? Do you see this the future in terms of government decisions and this sort of coexistence in community environments and this different way of being into the future?
Yeah, look, I think that's a frontier. There's a lot of work going on that collective decision-making. That coexistence word is a really nice word. In terms of community wind farms specifically, there's one other in Australia. So if you're an Australian looking at this, you might think it was a very novel new idea, and we'll wait and see whether it really has what it takes to be around. But in Europe, there are thousands of them, and in North America, there are thousands of them. In fact, in Germany, the community-owned wind farm sector employs 90,000 people. So it's a very well-established, well-proven territory. It's just one of the many things that frustrates me about Australia is for some reason, and I really can't get my head around it, and I do wonder whether it goes back to, you know, our unique modern history of convicts and landholder class and squatocracy and so on. But our energy industry is not that different to our grocery industry, which is not that different to our mining industry or our media industry, by which I mean there's essentially a couple to a handful of companies that dominate an entire industry. And it's amazing. And I don't know what it is about Australians that we're so comfortable to leave our choices to be Coles or Woolworths or Origin or AGL. And that pattern plays out across sectors. So what we're doing in Australia, one of the reasons it's challenging is because we're asking individuals and businesses to consider putting $10,000 into a community wind farm that would produce the equivalent of their electricity forever. And they're shocked by that idea, but they're quite happy to pay $1,500-$2,000 a year to AGL or Origin, who are making 30% per annum out of them. And I don't get it. I've got a financial background, so I don't get it, because financially it's just lunacy, really. but I also don't get it that we just don't have competition. We've got about 18 electricity companies in Australia, and we've got a population of about 25 million people. Switzerland has a population of about 12, 14 million people, and they have 1,400 electricity companies. So it's just whichever way we look at it, Australia is very uncompetitive in that sense, that we've got oligopolies, monopolies, duopolies, tightly held industries that make an absolute mozza. And we're quite happy to be employees and not owners. We're quite happy to be customers and not shareholders. I don't know what that is, but I do believe that's another frontier of change for Australia compared to if we were to look at Germany, say, which is one of the strongest European companies, if we were to compare their economic credentials at the moment to the rest of Western Europe going through this great recession. One of the reasons that Germany is so strong is because of the level of small and medium-sized and community-owned business. Businesses who, when you own it yourself, you make different decisions about laying off staff when things get tough, because your main purpose is not just to make the most money you humanly can within the bounds of the law, if not beyond it. So, you can see now why I get quite passionate about the economic aspect of the community wind farm, even though it's got really good environmental credentials as well. But all of this, I think, is reflecting our social outlook, that we have a social outlook that sort of creates the limits to what we're willing to do. And for some reason, in this respect in Australia, we're quite limited in our thinking.
You're listening to Health and Happiness Show on Untangled FM. I'm Edwina Griffin, speaking with community entrepreneur and social change strategist Adam Blakester. Adam, so speaking about this need for social change on some levels, maybe could you have a bit of a chat to us about the Mile Creek Massacre Memorial, and because that's sounding like a positive movement towards our way of thinking and collaborating and connecting with one another. What exactly did that involve, and how did that come about?
Yes, so the specific piece of work that we're involved with is a fairly dry, by comparison, a fairly dry exercise. It's to develop a business plan for them, to establish a cultural and education centre. Now, the significance of that, I mentioned before the significance of Mile Creek as being the only massacre of Aboriginal people in Australia, and there are, I think there's something like 350 documented massacres in Australia, and Mile Creek was the only one where the perpetrators of the massacre, the murderers, were found guilty at law and tried and in fact were hung for that. The other significance, though, is that because we're looking on behalf of the committee, we're looking at what would it take to establish a permanent facility there. At the moment, Mile Creek has an annual memorial, which occurs on the long weekend in June, where literally thousands of people come together for a ceremony, a remembrance ceremony that's led both by the descendants of the victims and the perpetrators. So it's a very significant exercise in reconciliation and healing, and we certainly need a lot more of that in Australia. There's still great rifts and great disconnections between Aboriginal, our First Peoples, and everyone else who's arrived in Australia since. But what is interesting is that conflict between settlers, colonisers, and First Nations is not unique to Australia. We can see similar patterns of conflict in the United States, similar patterns of conflict in South America, in Canada, etc. That pattern of colonial versus First People conflict and where it has, you know, degraded into massacres, violent conflict, even attempted genocide, as was the case here in Tasmania. That's a common pattern, you know, and common patterns can be nice or otherwise, and this obviously is not a nice one. What is remarkable is that we cannot find anywhere in the world a permanent educational and cultural facility that's been established to remember, to understand, to learn, and to create far deeper cultural, cross-cultural understanding and respect from one of these massacres. Now, that amazes me. That amazes me given that we're talking thousands and thousands of massacres. It amazes me because given that it was Anzac Day here in Australia just yesterday, the number of memorials and facilities and educational programs that go into understanding military history. If we were to look at the Jewish massacres in the Second World War, there are countless numbers of facilities. I've spent a lot of time in Anne Frank House in Amsterdam as one example of a facility set up to bring the relevance of the Holocaust into a modern contemporary setting, which is issues around racism, issues around bullying, issues around violence, etc. Yet if we were to narrow our focus down to say, okay, now I'm interested in just the massacres between white and black people, colonial and First Nations people, give me one permanent, ongoing, year-round education and cultural facility, and we cannot find one. And that, for me, symbolises where we are at in this process of reconciliation and healing, is that we are at the very beginnings of it still. I mean, we've had a national apology in Australia. We've had inquiries into stolen generations. We've had inquiries into stolen wages. We have Mabo and Native Title. And all of those things are positive developments, undeniably, in my view, having worked in this area. I think they're extraordinarily positive moves. But I also think we have such a long way to go to relate to each other as peers, to respect and be, you know, to have an experience of awe and wonderment in this country of knowing and understanding what is the world's oldest continuous culture. We're just at the very beginning of it. And Mile Creek, for me, is a representation, an embodiment of those things in many ways.
That's an exciting project. So you're in the process of building that facility, or is that the plan?
Yeah, planning for the building. So we're looking at different ways that this kind of education and this kind of cultural program can be delivered. It's obviously a fairly sensitive and evocative story to be able to portray for school students or university students or tourists. So we're looking at that. We're looking at the financial aspects of, you know, literally building a building or a range of buildings and facilities there that would enhance the existing memorial, and looking at what it would take to raise the money, not only to establish it, but also to maintain that, ideally in perpetuity into the future. For us, this is something that should be set up with a foundation, like a philanthropic trust, with sufficient money there that the ongoing educational programs can be run just using the interest on the money that they've got in the bank, so that they're not threatened by, oh, did we get 1,000 tourists through this week and therefore we're financially viable. For us, the Mile Creek Massacre Memorial has the same significance as the National War Memorial or the National Museum of Australia. It for sure can go and raise donations and get sponsorship, but the core of it should be something that is paid for, by the Australian people, because it's such a significant part of our history and our future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a very important project. And then the other area, the other project, you're in very different areas, but all along the same vein of a future of this collective and working coexistence together. But you're also mentioning the regenerative agricultural project, the Living Classroom that you're involved with. And how is that going about? How are you going about that, and how is that working in terms of an example for our future way of agriculture and production?
Yeah, some of the aspects of that are most significant for me are, for instance, you know, food's a big issue, and I think even more importantly than food is nutrition. So the qualities of the food we produce are really important. And one of the cutting edge areas of agriculture now is the whole science of soil and the understanding of nutrients and nutrient cycles and soil. And our agricultural model in the last, you know, 100 odd years, the industrial agricultural model, as it's often described, has been a model where nutrients have been externally added in terms of fertilizer, for instance. Whereas the future, for a whole range of reasons, is more about how do we grow soil? Because if we can grow soil, then we don't need to externally supplement that with fertilizers. And of course, most of the fertilizers that we have used have been derived from fossil fuels. So we have the same challenges with, you know, fertilizers in terms of increasingly scarce resources and becoming more costly and so on. But also they're non-replenishable, non-renewable. That's what fossil means, whether it's fossil fuel oil or whether it's fossil water in the Great Artesian Basin. Either way, they're not replenished in human timescales, not even close. So they create, and with 7 billion growing to 10 billion people, create very quickly shortages and scarcity. So one of the things the Living Classroom is looking at is the agricultural practices and methodologies that grow soil. And so there's a real focus on that, and that's become popular also in recent terms because there's some fairly good indications that healthier soil also holds significantly more carbon than degraded soil. So there's the potential for soil to be a place that can sequester carbon. There's still a lot of work going on as to just how much and how you measure that. But suffice to say that healthy soil is much healthier in a whole range of ways, as is the food that's then produced on it, whether we're talking, you know, grass-fed cattle or whether we're talking growing crops and grain on those soils. So this Living Classroom is going to showcase a whole range of different regenerative agricultural practices, everything from intensive farming and another type of farming they describe as polyculture, where you have, it's a bit like permaculture, where you have a whole lot of different complementary food growing and grazing practices that all complement each other and enhance their productivity. So the way that you have, you know, birds, fowl, chickens, geese and so on working over intensive vegetable gardens and working with cattle through grassed areas and practices like cell grazing or pulse grazing with cattle that are much more, profoundly more sustainable than broad acre cattle grazing. So it's the interesting thing for me is not only all of these practices, but that they're creating something of they call it the Living Classroom. So there's a small version of what then could be deployed on a much larger scale on a commercial farm. So there's partnerships with commercial farms that sit to the side of the Living Classroom, whereby the way that they're working out, for instance, grazing practices for cattle, where on the Living Classroom they might have a herd of cattle that's only 50 or 80 head, but then through these partnerships with commercial graziers, we'll be able to apply those practices to herds of 1,000 or 2,000 head of cattle. And so that's how it will make a difference not only as an educational facility in its own right, but also as a working demonstration that can be deployed at scale in the commercial realm of agriculture.
Just a quick question. I'm conscious of time, but I when you talk about growing soil, you know, from my understanding of, with organics and things, there's usually a sort of time period of, I thought it was at least 5 years of not being able to do any agriculture for, in terms of all the nutrients in the soil being replenished and the whole cycle, you know, replenishing. How are you talking about speeding up that process when you talk about growing soil, or allowing for that in terms of improving soil quality?
Look, I don't know the exact answer to that, Edwina. That's a level of detail I've not gotten into on this project yet. But suffice to say, this project's got a long...
long way. It's a process. That is part of the process, I guess, exploring all of that.
Oh, it is. And at the moment, the town commons, the area that has been converted into this living classroom, it's been a neglected piece of open grassland, basically. The first phase of this project is to actually create this farm. And so some of the work that has been done already is creating a whole series of swales, so land formations, that have shifted the way the stormwater flows across the site. And in simple terms, instead of it moving across the site at a cracking pace, causing erosion problems and, in fact, closing off streets in the town when there's heavy rain, it now moves sideways across the site and through a series of lakes and ponds. It still moves right across the site, but it moves across the site so much more slowly that it hydrates the site. And, I mean, this is just a small example of, you know, again, one of these big paradigm changes. When we think about water and water security, most often what people think about is great big dams. The percentage of water that ends up in dams is something like 5% of what falls, and then you've got issues with evaporation and so on. The far greater water resource is water that is stored in the landscape. And so that hydrating of the landscape is a very early step towards that soil growing process that we're talking about, of just having the moisture there to be able to do that. So as the project is developed, it's practicing what they're preaching. I expect it will take 5 to 10 years before they have thriving examples of these things, you know, in the way that you're saying it. That's not an overnight process, but that's okay,
yeah.
Because
but the
part
potential,
of the learning is...
Yeah, the potential. Sorry.
Yeah.
The potential for a project like this in terms of funding, you know, through the future is... huge, and obviously bring down the cost for all of us, for the organics and everything. That's a potentially a huge shift to the food industry and for affecting all of us. I'm quite excited with hearing that about that project. So some amazing projects that Starfish is involved in. You know, we've gone from sort of clean energy and wind farming to reconciliation and healing and coexistence and connecting people to regenerative agriculture and growing soil. Starfish is doing some amazing work. Now, if people are wanting to contact you or look at the projects, or what's the best way for people to get in contact? And is there anything else that you need from the general population now to help with what you're doing?
Oh, look, the website is definitely the best way to find out more and make contact with us. And like most organisations these days, we've got a Facebook accounts, and you know, there's sort of daily conversations on Facebook and then less regular newsletters and things that flow through the website. We're particularly interested to hear from other community entrepreneurs. There's a growing number of people who, you know, I thought about this the other day, and I thought, you know, we used to talk about making a living, and more recently we've talked about making a difference. What we're on about is making a different living. This is a way of making a living that makes a difference. And so we're always really keen to hear from people who have an interest in that space, because this work does need to be led. It does take incredible tenacity and innovation and creativity. And equally, anyone who just wants to stay in touch, be kept informed, or has a, you know, specific interest in those projects or others we're working on in a specific way, they can drop us an email.
Okay, great. So the website's starfishenterprises.net. So people can contact Adam that way. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today. Some fantastic information. I feel a lot more informed in this area, and I'm quite excited about all the work you're doing. I'm going to keep a close eye and see all the developments on all those projects and the ones coming forward. So thanks, everyone, for joining us. Next week on the Health and Happiness Show, I'll be speaking to a woman about the role of our spiritual practice plays in health and happiness. I'm Edwina Griffin. Tune in next week at 8 a.m. Aus time, 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and 11 p.m. London time. See you then. Speak to you then.